Hello, welcome to Counting the Earth, the new podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Sue Nelson.
And I'm Alice Hope. In this podcast, we explore the environment and nature through the lens of one number. And our number today is zero, as in net zero.
Which is why we've left the studio and I've brought Alice to my happy place. It's a huge carbon capture and storage facility. Well, nature's version to be exact, because we're in a forest. And in today's episode, we're going to dig into the ways that nature, the environment, the way we use and manage land can help contribute to that goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050.
Coming up, Dr. Amanda Thompson from the UKCEH is going to walk us through the UK's plans and progress for reaching net zero through nature-based solutions.
And I'll be visiting the Fens to see how peatlands can be both villain and hero in the quest for reducing climate change.
We're all on borrowed time here. Whether you've got 2 metres of peat or 2 centimetres left, it's all going to be gone. Whether we like it or not, we've got to, at some point, change something.
And we'll be talking about net zero plus too, so lots to talk about. But before we get into that, Sue, tell me about this forest. Why have you brought me to this particular one?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. The first being that Hartwood Forest in Hertfordshire, which is where we're standing now, is England's largest planted native woodland. And as you can see from where we are surrounded by an array of trees. And the other reason I've brought you here is that this is my happy place. And during the pandemic, this was where I would come, because it's not that far from where I live, to just get away from it all and just enjoy nature. And it's beautiful for wildflowers. You often, well, you can hear amazing birds here, apart from occasionally a distant train in the background. But it really is a special place. And this land, which the Woodland Trust bought quite recently, really, in 2008, it was to create a new forest, to join up pockets of existing forest and arable land all around us. But it was a massive project. It was 10 years long. And that 10-year project, they planted over 500,000 trees.
Wow.
Yeah. And I planted about 50 of them, because they involved local schools, local people in coming to do it. So my husband, my son, we've all planted the newer trees, which aren't around us at the moment, but we can walk across to a sort of more newly recently planted area a little later on. So this has a great connection to me. And now there are over 1 million trees on this site.
That is an incredible number, isn't it? And to have planted them yourself as well, to really feel connected to the space in that way, must be so lovely to then come and watch it grow.
It is, and it's amazing how quickly they have grown, actually. But also, you also realise, hold on, that was over 10 years ago. And then you also realise it takes time. Before we go any further, let's get down to basics. What does the zero in net zero actually mean?
So net zero is the aim to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to an overall figure of zero by balancing the greenhouse gases we release into the air, what's known as carbon sources, with things that remove carbon from the atmosphere and lock it away, which are known as carbon sinks. We'll talk a lot about carbon emissions or carbon dioxide emissions, but it's worth noting that there are other greenhouse gases like methane and nitrous oxide that we're trying to reduce emissions of too. And the reason we're aiming for net zero is to prevent an increase in global temperatures above 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels, to reduce the severity of climate change. So obviously really important. Net zero is a global ambition, so timescales do vary by country. But as you said already, in the UK, the aim is to reach net zero by 2050.
You hear the phrase carbon budget a lot. What does that actually mean?
We have a body called the Independent Committee on Climate Change in the UK. This is a team of experts that come together to produce a kind of roadmap of how to reduce our emissions, and proposes targets to hit along the way. And those are known as carbon budgets, and we're on our 6th carbon budget now. But the government is ultimately responsible for deciding on how closely they want to follow that roadmap.
Right, okay. So do people then have a target, a bit like a household budget? Is that the equivalent, that each country has a target of carbon emissions they should reduce to.
Yes, and then it's about balancing that budget between those sources and sinks that we've already talked about.
And a sink is a tree, which is, you know, what we're surrounded by now. But trees aren't the only nature-based solution. And to find out what the other carbon sources and sinks are that you referred to, we spoke to Dr. Amanda Thompson. She's led the work for UKCEH on land use and net zero for the UK's sixth carbon budget to find out what else can make a difference. And I started by asking her how much putting food on the table helps or hinders our net zero ambitions.
The problem is there's lots of biological and chemical processes you get in crop and livestock production that you can only reduce so far, and that means it isn't always possible to easily cut emissions. Land use and farming are responsible for about 12% of the UK's emissions. Agriculture is about 10% of that, and a lot of that is coming from livestock. It's coming from what's called enteric fermentation.
Are you talking farting? Yes.
Basically, farting cows. But also from manure and how you manage that manure and if you spread it on the land. When it comes to the land use and forestry, it's actually a really small number. It's a tiny percentage if you just look at the net value for the UK. That's actually really finely balanced. You've got sources of greenhouse gas emissions on one side, and that might come from degraded soil like your peatlands. It might come from harvesting. It might come from the way you're managing your land. And then on the other side, in the sinks, you've got trees growing and also from good management of your soils. You actually want to increase the sinks, but you also want to reduce the sources. A double whammy, if you like.
We're reliant on agriculture and farming for food. And you've got to balance this, haven't you, in terms of reducing emissions, but also thinking about travel of food. What kind of changes are possible to make farming greener?
It's not just the food miles, a much bigger source of emissions if you've got deforestation for cattle pasture or for growing soy crops, for example. And those can produce much higher emissions abroad than you would get within the UK. There are ways of making food production more efficient, and that will reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. There's various high-tech solutions involving cows farting less, or at least farting less methane. You might have more carbon storage on your farm by increasing the amount of hedgerows you've got, or just the trees you've got there generally.
What about those natural sinks that you mentioned? Are there options to use natural processes to pull carbon out of the atmosphere and store it to sort of reduce the emissions that way?
A key one is increasing tree cover in the UK. Now, that's not just planting big areas of plantation. It's also about increasing hedgerows, shelter belts, things like that. And we're not talking massive, massive changes here. We're going from about 13% of the UK being tree covered, maybe getting up to 19%. That's still way below tree cover in the rest of Europe. We already have big carbon stores in soils in the UK, but they are being degraded. Some of the options are restoring peatlands, for example, which have very high carbon soils. You reduce drainage, you maybe raise the water level. And you've also got another potential natural sink is salt marshes. Now, we don't know much about them at the moment, but there's a lot of research going on. And what it's showing is that salt marshes can actually have really high carbon storage rates per hectare when compared to weather habitats. They're quite small, but they can be really powerful.
Thanks to Dr. Amanda Thompson for running us through the options for sources and sinks in the environment. And we'll hear more from Amanda later to discuss how the UK is getting on in its quest to reach net zero by 2050.
Now, we're in the middle of a natural carbon sink right now in Hartwood Forest. But another example that Amanda mentioned there was peatlands. Now, these are the unsung heroes of the natural carbon sinks. And while rainforests might get all the attention, I was amazed to discover that peatlands can store more carbon than any other terrestrial ecosystem, both in the UK and globally.
I had no idea. When we talk about peat, I think of what we used to get from the garden centre to pot
Me
up the
too.
Plants, or the really sort of boggy bits on moorlands that are all squelchy. So how can it be so efficient?
Well, peat soils are those with a much higher percentage of organic matter and in its natural waterlogged state. And as plants grow from the trees around us to the kind of marshy-loving shrubs you might find in peatlands, they pull in CO2. But when the plants on peatlands die off, instead of decomposing as normal and so releasing the carbon dioxide back into the air, the stems and the leaves and the roots get buried under the waterlogged conditions. So the usual methods of decomposition can't happen, and this means most of the captured carbon is stored in the ground. But given enough time and heat and compression, peat would eventually turn into coal. In its natural waterlogged condition, peat can accumulate carbon at a rate of around 1 millimetre a year. Now, that doesn't sound much, but when it can keep doing that for thousands of years, you can then understand why it's considered such a great carbon sink.
Do we have a lot of peatlands in the UK?
Well, I was surprised to discover that around 10% of the UK is peatland. But that includes not just the boggy patches on moorlands, but also lowland peat, which is now highly productive agricultural land. In its natural state, it would be flooded, but for centuries it's been drained so it can be farmed for crops or grazing. And here we're getting onto the problem, as it's that lowland peat that's responsible for a lot of the emissions from peatlands. A prime example is the fens around Cambridgeshire. So I went there to meet UKCEH peatlands expert Professor Chris Evans and farmer Craig Taylor to find out how they're tackling this problem. And as you'll hear when we gathered at Craig's Mount Pleasant farm, the weather was nowhere near as nice or dry as it is here in this forest. Well, I must admit, I couldn't have picked a worse day to come and visit your lovely farm. We're freezing cold. We're sort of shivering. Well, at least I am, beside a tractor shed. Gravel beneath us, overlooking one of your fields, and squalls of rain.
That's just a fine Fenland day. This is a good day.
It could be worse.
So tell us a little bit about this farm. How big is it and what sort of crops do you grow here?
Yeah, so myself and my cousin, we farm about 800 acres just here. Normal Fenland farm, so it's potatoes, sugar beet, wheat, then there's some land rented out for onions and bits and pieces like that.
And is the whole of this farm peatland?
Yep, every acre we've got is of a peaty soil. We're between kind of 30 and up to 60 centimetres thick of black land, what we'd call it.
And I saw that black land driving here. It's really quite striking. But this peatland was drained quite a while ago, wasn't it?
What was we, about 370 years ago, something like that?
16 something.
It was sort of 3-4 metres thick. And yeah, we've got 10% of that left. So that's all up in the sky. It's all oxidised and gone.
So what made you decide to re-wet your peatland soil?
Well, once we realised the amount of carbon dioxide was being emitted from our soil, we realised that we've got to do something about that. And not only by re-wetting does that stop the carbon being released, but we get the massive benefits of biodiversity, flood mitigation, and all of these add-ons automatically. It all just interlinks with each other. The carbon, the biodiversity, each one draws down the other one and provides the other one. That's the important thing to us.
And in terms of increasing your biodiversity here, are you talking species of insects, different crops you can grow?
Everything, because right down to the worms, we've not got as many worms as we should have. They're the things what are pulling down some carbon. You've got the plants what are drawing the carbon in. The birds, what everyone judges a reserve on, they're kind of the cherry on the cake. We've got no pollinators, we've got no fish in the water, we've got nothing. So that's our responsibility to help put that back.
Well, you had Craig there, Chris, talk about it from a sort of farmer's point of view. From your viewpoint, what sort of contribution can farmers make in terms of reducing CO2 emissions?
Well, huge. I mean, there are big areas of peat all around the fens here and in other parts of England and across the UK which are drained. They were drained, you know, as we said, some of them hundreds of years ago for agriculture. They've been gradually depleting ever since, the soils, as Craig said, putting CO2 in the atmosphere. If we can reduce that, you know, by working between ourselves and the farming sector and everybody else with an interest in this all the way up to government, there's potential to have quite a significant impact on the UK's greenhouse gas emissions overall by doing that.
I must admit, this does seem a ridiculous question to ask when we're standing in the rain, but how do you re-wet peatlands?
Difficulty.
Yeah, that is what we're all working on together. We've got a room full of scientists at the moment in the office, and we're coming up with a plan on how to do that.
You know, this land is below sea level. It's only the way it is because of drainage.
And I passed fields that were flooded.
It's been exceptionally wet this winter. It didn't look like this summer before last. It was bone dry and everything was blowing away. So it's, I mean, that's part of the challenge, isn't it, with climate extremes. But the problem is you could re-wet the whole thing, but you'd be flooding people's houses, you'd be taking a lot of agricultural land out of production. That would have a huge economic and social impact. But to do it field by field is really hard because, you know, trying to keep one bit of the landscape wet while the bit next to it is dry. You know, water moves with gravity, the water's going to go downhill. So it's really challenging, and so it's actually a scale issue a little bit. The more people that start to change what they do, actually the easier it starts to get.
I know it's the obvious thing to think that turning the pumps off and re-wetting the whole lot, but all you'd end up with is a big cesspit because you'd have 2 to 3 metres deep of just dirty, polluted water.
Yeah.
We've got the main freight line coming from Felixstowe to Peterborough for trains. We've got like electric pylons running through here. That's without houses, businesses. Yeah. It's about everyone. So
I think absolutely that I don't think there's any serious suggestion of reflooding the whole area, but I think, and it needs to be a mosaic, it needs to be the right measures in the right places, it needs an understanding. You look out there and you think it's flat, but it's not really. There's a little rise over there, and somewhere over there there's the ewe washes, which are 2 metres higher, and at least,
yeah,
I guess.
So
it's, it needs a slightly more intelligent approach.
And this has this name, which I had not come across before, and I hope I'm going to pronounce it correctly, polluticulture.
Polluticulture. So it's
which sounds a little rude, but
It is a bit of a dirty word in some circles. So depends which farmer you talk to. It's a tricky one. So the idea of polluticulture is basically wetland farming. I mean, if you think of rice is kind of polluticulture, doesn't sound too mad because that feeds quite a lot of the world's population. But in this landscape, we're looking at, you know, producing reeds for building materials. I mean, that historically did happen in some parts of East Anglia, not so much now, or other novel products or, you know, different things you might grow here, but keeping the water levels high because that will stop that carbon loss. But the challenge really is it's partly practical and it's partly economic because this is really high value agricultural land. This is providing food that feeds the nation, and it's hard for reeds or something like that to compete economically with lettuces or wheat or maize. So that's the challenge, really. It's got to be an economic model that works for the farmers because, I mean, perhaps not everyone's quite as on board with this as you, Craig, I guess.
No, and that's fair enough. Yeah. I mean, there's generations gone into these farms, the knowledge, the infrastructure, blood, sweat and tears have built these farms to get to where they are, to literally be unviable by growing something that's not market ready, like reeds or something. We're willing in this situation to change and help combat these things, but these boys doing the science, we've still got things to work out. You can't go and preach at a farmer to change when you don't know all the measurements and everything, what's actually happening.
I mean, it's people's livelihoods. That's the way I look at it. You're asking people to take a financial risk for the public good. If you can't finance
that. It's very altruistic, it sounds.
Well, it's a big ask, and you can see why people say no, because if you say, well, turn your land over to this, and actually, that turned out not to work.
But you're hoping it will work, obviously, Craig. Will you have to change your crops at all when this re-wetting is done? And over how many years will it take?
Well, on our land, there won't be any crops what we currently grow on it that will be re-wetted to do things like Chris has just said, but also where we can't do that, it will be grazing. So we can still get grass-fed meat, sheep or cattle on here, so you can get a good protein from there. That's how we see it. Last thing we want to do is offshore food across the world. Like, we're emitting so much carbon, but if we're going to chop a rainforest down, what's the point?
Yeah.
So we've got to make a mosaic of habitat and sort of increase the pollinators, which helps the really efficient farming in the area, and raise the water tables on some of them areas, and then other land was perhaps not as good, put over to these things and graze it instead. So it's going to be a mosaic approach, yeah, to cure it. There's no one answer, and we've all got to do our bit to help sort these problems out, but we mustn't do them in vain to just let someone else crack on with like polluting the planet.
The UK could get to net zero by shifting all of its industry and all of its food production and all those other things to other countries, but that wouldn't help the atmosphere in any way, shape or form. It would just make us poorer and more dependent on imports. So that's not the solution.
And this field that we're in front of is going to be one of these trial fields, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So this will be our first polluticulture trial, working with these gang. We're going to trial growing a load of these different crops and materials, what you just mentioned, all of which used to grow down here. My great-great-granddad was a basket maker just the other side of Ely. They had the, I don't know if you pronounce it, osier or osier beds, which is the willow and whatnot. They were coming along this ancient load, ox willow load. They'd be on their punt taking their polluticulture crops and their reeds for their thatching and the willow and that for basket making and things. Obviously, we're probably not going to be basket makers, but we're in the abnormal now. What we're doing is the abnormal.
Sort of returning to the landscape in terms of what it was best used for.
You know, Ely Cathedral was built before the fens were drained. There was a lot of highly productive agricultural land in this area back in the day. It was just a different type of land management and different products coming from the land, but it's not that a wet landscape can't be productive.
Well, we're getting some wind sort of beating up now.
And the rain's eased off.
But let's look at the future. Having heard some of these challenges, do you think, Chris, that the government is being a little bit too optimistic about the impact? Because I looked on the website, the Natural England, and it basically said, is polluticulture, you know, the future, or could it be the future?
Well,
which it could be, I mean, but it's a big load.
It's a question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think the answer's yes to some extent, but I don't think it's the answer everywhere for the reason that we still need to produce food, obviously. And I think it's got to be economic and it's got to be productive. So I mean, a lot of the work we're doing, and we've got a new project with DEFRA, which they're supporting, is not about that. It's about how do we take these farm landscapes and how do we manage them to reduce that emission whilst keeping the farming on the land, because that's the other solution here, is to come up with different methods of farming, be a bit, you know, smarter with the water management. Could you bring the water level up while there's nothing on the field? That kind of thing. It's all the tradition of internal drainage boards, which are the people that manage the land, is get the water low and keep it low to some extent. So it's about changing the ethos and bringing in the technology and the infrastructure to do that. So it's not either or, it's both.
And Craig, will your crops in the future include, you know, you mentioned willow and going back to what your ancestors used to work with. I know that sort of bulrushes and that lots of particular type of moss, which are actually really quite important today. Would you be looking to using those as crops as well?
Yeah, we're trialling all of those things. We're going to try everything.
And how are you thinking about the future, bearing in mind that climate change is already with us, floods, drought? Do you think you're switching your peatland farms and re-wetting it will better withstand those sort of conditions that farmers and everyone is currently having to deal with?
Yeah, because you create a microclimate. Everything what you take out or you re-wet or you turn to grassland, you're cooling the climate down by a degree or two within that local landscape. You haven't got that sun bearing down on that bare soil. You're already changing it instantly on your own. Well, if everyone does a bit, that mounts up.
In general, a wet peat is going to be better able to withstand a, you know, extreme conditions than a dry one. I mean, in 2022, the summer, it was so dry the peat was turning to dust and, you know, and blowing away, and that's bad news for everybody.
We're all on borrowed time here. Whether you've got 2 metres of peat or 2 centimetres left, it's all going to be gone. Whether we like it or not, we've got to, at some point, change something. Or we're lucky, we've got some nice clay under here, so we could carry on growing wheat and things like that. Some places where they've got gravel or something horrible underneath, or real acid stuff, their soils perhaps won't be so easy to work as what ours will. But that carbon will still be gone. So the high value crops definitely won't be grown in the fen anyway. You've only got a certain amount of years to grow them, and that's gone.
Farmer Craig Taylor and Professor Chris Evans on the importance of preserving our peatlands.
You really drew the short straw in terms of the weather there. It sounded horrible.
Honestly, it took me about an hour or so to get some feeling in my feet. That's all I can say. Well, we've moved now to a different location with some relatively newly planted trees. This isn't the area where I've planted trees, but this is a part of Hartwood Forest where I go looking for wildflowers, actually. And we're beside a lovely tree here that's only probably about under 4 metres, 3 metres high, with gorgeous catkins on it.
Yes, it's a beautiful hazel tree, and there's hazel here, but other species as well. We've got silver birch and dog rose. So there's a really nice mixture of broadleaf species that are all native to the UK. And by having a more mixed forest, you're going to support a more diverse ecosystem. So it is really important.
That's right. And where we were earlier, that's part of the older ancient woodlands. And one of the reasons I realised it was an ancient woodland is that on one of my many walks through here, I'm taking photographs and identifying flowers and berries and shrubs, and I came across Gelder Rose. And I've never come across Gelder Rose before, and when I looked it up, it said that that is a species indicative of an ancient woodland.
Yes, and the really good thing they've done here is we've got a mixture of ancient woodland and new woodland, and that goes back to what Chris was saying about the mosaic approach and linking up slightly different habitats in one landscape so that you can support a greater diversity.
And I love that word, paludiculture, even if I'll never be able to use it in everyday conversation. At least I know what it means.
You do, and it does make you laugh
a
lot.
It does.
It's one of the several options that nature can offer us to get to net zero. And it might seem that reducing sources of greenhouse gas emissions and increasing sinks is simple on paper, at least. But Sue, as you witnessed out in the fens, implementing these plans in real life is a lot more tricky. And for all the examples like Hartwood Forest that are forging ahead on tree planting goals, it may seem like we're doing well on that front. And that's something that I asked Amanda Thompson about. Is the UK on track for the amount of trees the government pledged to plant before 2050?
They were very ambitious aspirations to get to planting a huge number of trees a year by 2025. But because of the pandemic, and it's been slow getting the policies and the subsidies in place to really encourage that, we're at about half the rate of what was planned for this stage.
And as we know, if you've ever had a tree growing in your garden, it's quite astonishing really how slowly they do grow. It does make you think that how realistic this target will be, because 2050 is only just over 25 years away. 25 years in tree growing terms is not terribly long.
A tree planted in 2025, say, will have a lot more impact in the amount of carbon it's stored by 2050 than a tree planted in the 2040s. A tree planted in the 2040s might actually be a carbon source in 2050 because of the disturbance and the emissions from the planting process. So we really need to crack on with doing things like afforestation now.
And are there any other things that are more technological or more engineered solutions?
you can have soil additions that can lock up carbon and improve soil quality. And one of those is biochar, which is an engineered charcoal type. And the other one is rock dust, which is, as it sounds, is very, very fine rock dust. And what both of those do is capture carbon dioxide from the air and lock it up in a stable form in the soil. Now, there's a lot of research going on that, both on how effective it is, but also if there's any unintended consequences for using those additions to the soil. But potentially they're very exciting and could operate very rapidly, more rapidly than some of the options like growing trees do, for example. But they're still at quite an early stage.
So thinking about all these different solutions, there's an astonishing number of different options here, but how much of a difference are these actually going to make?
Well, I've done quite a lot of modelling with colleagues for the Committee on Climate Change for this. For the sixth carbon budget, we modelled for them that you could get a reduction in the emissions from the combined agriculture and land use section of 40% by 2035 or 75% by 2050. And if you went with some of the more ambitious pathways, we could actually get to net zero for the whole sector by 2047.
Wow, okay, that is quite a significant difference then. If we go all the way, then we could get to net zero earlier than we were planning to.
Difficulty is people want to treat the land use sector as a silver bullet that's then going to offset lots of the emissions from other sectors. But even just offsetting emissions from agriculture is quite challenging. We've also got to remember a lot of the land-based solutions like tree planting and soil restoration, they take time. We really need to crack on. There are times when I wish we'd do a bit more action, a little less modelling, but coming from a modeller, that's maybe a little bit counterintuitive.
So is net zero then realistic by 2050?
I think it's realistic if we're ambitious and we don't try and put all our eggs in one basket and say carbon capture and storage will get us out of the hole, because carbon capture and storage is not at the scale yet to do that. It may well be really important in the 2040s, but we need to make sure we're doing other things now. And I think there is potential for us to get very close. The UK has been a world leader in how we approach this. We have slipped back in the last couple of years, but it wouldn't take too much extra effort to get back to being world leading in how we approach this in the future.
Thanks, Amanda.
Amanda talked a lot about tree planting there, like they've been doing at Hartwood Forest. And the reason that tree planting is so effective is because four trees will mitigate 1 ton of CO2 over their lifetime. So that's a quarter of a ton per tree. And we're using 100 years as the lifetime of a tree. So a very sort of rough back of the envelope estimate would suggest that the trees they've planted here have the potential to sequester 1,375 tons of carbon over 100 years. The average person has a footprint of about 5.5 tons per year. So that's 22 trees per year people should be planting just to mitigate their own carbon.
Now, I was feeling quite good about all my tree planting until I heard that figure, because I reckon I planted about 50 or 60 trees here in this forest. But obviously, it's a reminder. I thought, wow, haven't I done well? Pat myself on the back. But actually, gosh, we need to do a whole lot more. And it was interesting to hear Amanda say that the pandemic had knocked things off track, when during that pandemic so many people realised the importance of trees and forests and green spaces and nature for our mental health. And that's on top of the crucial benefits for climate change and achieving net zero. So what about net zero plus then? We tease that at the start of the podcast, and we can't avoid it any longer.
Net zero plus doesn't have a strict set definition, but at UKCEH we use it to describe the idea that we can't just focus on carbon and we can't just focus on greenhouse gases. We have to consider the pros and cons of these actions on people and the environment more broadly. So we need to consider things like food production, biodiversity, soil health, water quality and air quality as well. And an example of where this might not work would be a poorly designed tree planting scheme, which does remove carbon, but because they use the wrong trees in the wrong places, biodiversity suffers because the trees can't support the local ecosystem.
I get it now. So from net zero to net zero plus, we really are counting the earth.
Exactly. From Hartwood Forest in Hertfordshire, thank you for listening and join us again next time.